Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Swanson, activist and author, who assesses the Obama administration's plans for withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan this July and talks about a major anti-war protest scheduled for October 6th. Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, who discusses fossil fuels' impact on the planet's ecosystem and the conditions necessary to change course. And Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine, who looks at the context of the current wave of sustained protest in Spain, challenging the nation's economic and political status quo. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Nearly a year after President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Act to reform the way big banks and Wall Street do business, the final rules have not been hashed out. ProPublica reports the regulatory process has been slowed down by high-powered banking lobbyists. Of particular concern to reformers is Julie Williams, chief counsel of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or OCC, who is pushing for new exemptions in the proposed regulations, giving banks more opportunity to engage in proprietary trading. Such activity by banks was banned under the so-called Volcker Rule, named after former Federal Reserve Chief Paul Volcker. The Dodd-Frank Act established 387 rules covering 20 different agencies in the 2,000-page bill. In recent weeks, New York lawmakers, including Senators Charles Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, signed a letter to regulators complaining that emerging rules on financial derivatives would put U.S. banks at a disadvantage. Moreover, the U.S. Treasury Department has proposed exempting some foreign exchange derivatives from the requirement that they must be traded on open exchanges. Despite mounting criticism, Congressman Barney Frank, co-author of the law, praised recent progress. This includes development of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, plus greater shareholder say over CEO pay and new protections for whistleblowers. On May 23rd, Haitian police started tearing apart three refugee settlements in Delmas, a self-governing area in the capital city of Port-au-Prince. On the order of Mayor Wilson Jeudy, security forces destroyed over 100 tents used by families and hauled away their belongings. The families were made homeless by the devastating 2010 earthquake that leveled Port-au-Prince. According to the website Other Worlds Are Possible, three residents of the camps were arrested and several community activists were beaten by police. Immediately after the raid, civil society activists, including attorney Patrice Forvalis of Defenders of the Oppressed and the group Force for Reflection and Action on Housing, or FRACA, condemned the eviction. Mayor Jeudy defended his action, saying he was trying to preserve public spaces. The mayor refused to offer compensation to those evicted, saying, "We are all victims of the earthquake." 2 days before the camp demolition in Delmas, several hundred displaced Haitians protested against evictions that took place at Camp Carrad. The action was part of the International Forum on the Housing Crisis, sponsored by dozens of Haitian grassroots organizations. The forum called for authorities to stop violence against displaced persons in camp raids. A deadly outbreak of a new strain of E. coli has killed 25 people in Germany and sickened over 2,000 people, with hundreds in intensive care. German public health officials are still searching for the source of the deadly E. coli, and the World Health Organization is warning that time is running out to find the source. German authorities initially blamed Spanish cucumbers and then lettuce, tomatoes, and cucumbers in Germany for the outbreak. Health officials also targeted a single farm that grew bean sprouts for the outbreak, but tests turned up negative. The new strain of E. coli can lead to kidney failure, seizure, or stroke, as the bacteria releases a toxin that destroys human blood cells. Most of the victims were adult women. The outbreak has led to new tensions between trading partners in the European Union. Spain has threatened to sue Germany for $300 million lost in produce crop profits. Russia also imposed a ban on vegetable imports from the EU because of the outbreak. A similar outbreak could occur in the U.S., since farmers and food processors are not required to test for the new E. coli strain. In recent years, American food safety experts have focused on new E. coli strains in meat, but the FDA has not required testing for E. coli in fresh produce. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
When President Obama announced his decision to deploy 30,000 additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan in December 2009, he also pledged to begin a withdrawal of those troops beginning July 2011. The promise to wind down the war in Afghanistan was politically necessary, with a growing number of U.S. citizens no longer supportive of a war that will be entering its 11th year this October. But with July's withdrawal date fast approaching, the White House is hinting that the withdrawal of U.S. troops may be larger than the anticipated token drawdown of 3,000 to 5,000 troops. How many American soldiers will come home in July is now being debated by the administration and the Pentagon. The competing arguments in play appear to be the symbolic impact of the U.S. raid, which killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, and the military's concern that a substantial withdrawal of American forces now would risk gains made against the Taliban insurgency by last year's troop surge. However, the mood among members of Congress has shifted, with many anti-war Democrats and anti-Obama Republicans casting nearly enough votes in May to pass a bill to accelerate the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Since the 2008 presidential election, the U.S. peace movement has waned, with fewer anti-war protests and less participation in vigils, teach-ins, and lobbying of Congress. But now, a new protest is being organized for October 6th, with the goal of placing new attention on the war in Afghanistan and demanding an end to the conflict as the U.S. military combat role there enters its second decade. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Swanson, co-founder of the group AfterDowningStreet.org, who discusses the Obama administration's plans for withdrawing U.S. forces from Afghanistan and the organizing now underway for a sustained and militant protest in Washington, D.C. on October 6th.
This is a president and a vice president and others in the administration who've been promising, swearing a significant, substantial withdrawal in July for a year and a half. And now in recent weeks you've heard, well, it might be 5,000 troops. Right. This is, and then you find out, well, it's actually troops and contractors adding up to 5,000, and that's not out of a total of 100,000. That's out of a total of 200,000 or so troops and contractors in Afghanistan. So that's about 2.5%. Now you start seeing numbers ranging from 3,000 to 5,000. So you've got a range of 1.5 to 2.5% of the Americans in Afghanistan being pulled out in July. And the New York Times, without suggesting any numbers, says, and it might be even more than that. Well, you know, it could be either extreme in this big range that they're now debating between 3,000 and 5,000 men and women. In either case, it doesn't begin to amount to what's been promised here, right? I mean, this is a president who did keep his promises on Afghanistan from the campaign. He said, I'm going to escalate it, that's the good war, and he did so. But later, as president, he promised a serious withdrawal this July, and now appears to be backing off from that. And, you know, we didn't elect him on that promise, and we can't vote him out on this backing off. We have to have some sort of way to pressure these people to listen to us in between elections.
Obama, when he talked about a withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan this summer, was vague, certainly, on the numbers, although substantial troops doesn't sound like just a few thousand, maybe support soldiers and contractors. What do you think would meet that pledge of Obama to withdraw a significant number of troops?
This is a president who has escalated this war by 60 or 70,000 troops, plus a similar number of contractors, and those have both been described as surges. You know, one was in 2009, happened with almost no public debate or discussion. The next one happened at the end of 2009 and in 2010, and there was a lot of discussion about it, and it was the big surge, and that's where the promise was made that the withdrawal would start in July, with a big withdrawal in July and proceeding from there. So as long as those are going to be considered surges, I think they have to end. I think you have to pull out those 70,000 troops plus contractors and get back to the level you were at before, and then continue, because the Afghan people don't want them there. The American people overwhelmingly don't want them there. The rule of law is against it. Our budget is against it. The natural environment, our civil liberties, our own representative government are against it. There's not an argument for staying.
David, you wrote a very interesting article recently titled Our Tahrir Square, D.C.'s Freedom Plaza on October 6th. You're proposing organizing a sustained protest movement a la Egypt, Tunisia, what's going on in Spain, that would not just be a nice Saturday afternoon out, as you said in the article, patting ourselves on the back for being good protesters, but actually a sustained movement that will have more impact here in the United States. Tell us about that proposal.
As I've talked to people around the country and I ask them, do you want to come to Washington for another rally or speeches or march or, you know, make home movies and go back home, there's not much interest. But do you want to come for the one big event that you'll be able to tell your grandkids you were part of, where we actually get in the way and shut things down and hurt the war machine and the Wall Street funding, misrepresenting government until it begins to listen to the people? Then they say, yeah, I'm there. I'll quit my job. I'll risk relationships with my loved ones. I'll do what it takes. I'll be there. And so it's not just me proposing this. A number of people and groups had this idea around the same time some weeks back and have now put together an initial coalition that's announced an invitation for more groups and organizations and individuals to join in. And you can actually go to October2011.org and sign up that you'll be there. You can even sign up, I'll be there only if at least 50,000 other people will be there with me. And then we'll fill you in on how many people are going to be there. I expect it will be well over that number. And the intention is very much to nonviolently occupy Freedom Plaza, which has a nice resonance with Tahrir Square, and to get in the way and to shut things down until our government begins to listen to us.
That was David Swanson, co-founder of the group AfterDowningStreet.org and author of the book War is a Lie. Learn more about plans for the October 6th protest in Washington, D.C. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nuclear plant disaster at Fukushima, Japan, has generated months of headlines around the world this year, but it was just last year that the massive oil spill caused by the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico was similarly in the news for months. Coal extraction is also costly to humans and the environment, whether in deep mines where many workers globally have died in accidents over the past year, or from black lung disease, which kills many more. Mountaintop removal coal mining in America's Appalachian Mountains has devastated communities and generated deadly air and water pollution. Even production of natural gas, which has been touted as the cleanest of fossil fuels, has led to deadly explosions and likely contamination of drinking water as a result of extraction methods such as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Michael Clare is professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's an authority on the interface between energy production and security, examining both military and environmental issues. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Professor Clare, who discusses fossil fuels' impact on human health and the planet's ecosystem, assessing the conditions necessary to change course.
Demand for oil is expected to increase about 25 to 30% over the next quarter of a century, and mostly that's going to come from the developing world, from China and India in particular, and a lot of that is a product of growing consumerism in those countries, especially people buying automobiles for the first time. When you have hundreds of millions of people suddenly entering the middle class and running out and buying cars, you're going to create an enormous demand for oil if those cars are powered by oil, which is the case most of the time. So if we go down that trajectory, there's going to be a huge increase in demand for oil.
Just talk a little about where the oil would come from.
Right. The fact of the matter is that most of what people call easy oil is now gone. Easy oil is the stuff that you get on land or in shallow coastal waters where you dig a drill into the earth and it comes spurting out, you know, gushers. That kind of stuff is all gone now. What's left is tough oil of one sort or another. It could be deep offshore, and you need multi-million-dollar, billion-dollar rigs like the Deepwater Horizon to go out in very deep water to get it. Or it's geologically complex, like Canadian tar sands. It's not oil at all. It's something else entirely, bitumen, that has to be converted into oil in a very costly, environmentally risky process. Or it's in the Arctic, and you have very difficult climate conditions to overcome. That's pretty much what's left of the world's oil at this point.
You know, a lot of politicians and industries in America are now saying, well, that's okay, because we'll go to this new thing, hydrofracking for natural gas as a replacement. And it is cleaner than oil, but there are a lot of problems with it, too. Can you talk about that in terms of a replacement fuel?
There's certainly a lot of attraction to relying more on natural gas because it releases less carbon dioxide than oil or coal when it's burned, but it still releases carbon dioxide. It doesn't escape entirely the problem of greenhouse gas emissions. It's just better than the other two. And we have a lot of it in the United States, so you avoid the trap of being dependent on foreign suppliers in places like the Middle East that are very problematic. But we shouldn't assume that getting it out of the earth is all that easy, because most of the natural gas in the U.S. is in deep underground shale formations or tight sands, so-called, and it's very difficult to get at it. You have to smash the rock. You have to fracture it or frack it, and that requires explosives and chemical poisons and a lot of water. And when you engage in those procedures, you wind up with a lot of toxic wastes.
Coal is the dirtiest fossil fuel of all, but there's a huge amount of it in the U.S., especially in the West, and companies are even talking about liquefying it to use in place of oil, which would be a disaster as far as the climate is concerned.
There's a tremendous amount of coal in the United States, but coal is something that comes in many different gradations. There's the hard, dark black coal, which burns very well, and there's brown coal, so-called, you know, less desirable coal that when it burns has a lot of impurities. And we've used up a lot of the really good coal, the anthracite, and what's left is of increasingly low grades of coal, which needs a lot of processing if you're going to use it without creating tremendous amounts of pollution. Or if you burn it, you are going to have ever-increasing levels of pollution. So the question is, you know, how much reliance do you want to have on coal? How much of the Earth's atmosphere do you want to pollute and destroy?
Michael Clare, I find all of this pretty depressing. Do you have any thoughts about how we could shift this terrible trajectory that we're on?
You know, my sense is, to be perfectly honest, is that Americans aren't suffering enough yet from the consequences of our reliance on the existing energy paradigm. That is, we continue to use oil as if it's going to exist forever and that there are no consequences for using it. And I think we have to see the negative consequences a little bit more before enough people are going to feel the need to make a change. There just isn't yet enough downsides experienced in people's everyday lives. We're beginning to see some of that, and, you know, in the higher prices of oil, that's a wake-up call. And I think that the freaky weather we're having is another wake-up call. But we're going to have to see a lot more of that before people say, enough, we need to do things differently. We haven't reached that point yet.
That was Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. His latest book is titled Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. For links to Professor Clare's recent articles, visit our website at btlonline.org. The economic crisis gripping Europe and government austerity measures have triggered angry demonstrations in major cities across the continent, including Athens, Paris, and London. More recently, young activists in Spain poured into the streets and, taking inspiration from the popular revolts in the Middle East and North Africa, have occupied Madrid's Puerta del Sol Square. There, Spaniards from all walks of life have gathered in unexpectedly large numbers to protest an economic and political system they say has given them no hope for the future. Activists in the square, who call themselves indignados, or the outraged, have organized themselves into a small city run by democratic councils. Police attempts to forcibly remove the demonstrators only swelled their numbers. The protest, which began on a small scale prior to local and regional elections on May 22nd, have spread across Spain to Barcelona and 50 other cities and towns, and are now in their fourth week. Many of the activists camped out in Puerta del Sol Square speak out on behalf of immigrants and against world hunger. But the major motivation for participation is the estimated 45% unemployment rate plaguing Spaniards under the age of 30. Even those lucky enough to have a job are frustrated by being stuck in temporary, poorly paid jobs that forces many to live with their parents. Anger at Spain's two major political parties, the center-left Socialists and the right-wing People's Party, has fueled demands for constitutional change to permit a political opening for other new electoral movements. Other demands include increased taxes on the rich, a higher minimum wage, and more control over big banks and financial institutions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine and author, who examines the current wave of sustained protests in Spain, challenging the nation's economic and political status quo.
If you think about it, what's crisis? A crisis is a disruption in the economy that affects the rich and the powerful. If tens of millions of people a year die of starvation, that's not a crisis. People are unemployed, that's not a crisis. It's only a crisis when it threatens profit. Then the media calls it a crisis. And then the powers that be try to solve the crisis, and they try to do it in a way that betters their own lot. Well, if the public buys that, then what you have is a situation where the public goes along with instructions from the top that says basically, look, you have to shoulder the burden, you have to get less income, you have to lose your job, you have to lose public services, and that's what happens. And the net result is that eventually the economy is righted and the great mass of people is weaker than they were before. So what's happening in Spain and in Greece, say, or it may even be larger, what's happening in these countries is that the public has decided, or at least a significant portion of the public has decided, hold on a second, the solution to this problem shouldn't be that the great bulk of us, that working people and young people and poor people, are worse off. It should be that we're better off. It should be that we not only get back to a situation in which the economy is functioning, and we not only get back to a situation in which the causes of these problems are no longer operative, but we should get back to a situation in which some justice has been attained. Maybe not as much as some of us would like, but more than we have now. And that we're better off. And so people take to the streets and they start to make demands. And what they're demanding is that we go forward in a way that isn't geared to profit the profit makers. It's geared instead to benefit those who have been on the bottom all along. And that's really what's happening. And then what happens, and you see it in Spain, you see it in Greece, you saw it before that in Argentina some years ago, what happens is the public starts to get aroused. And it might be a small event that kicks it off, say in North Africa. A particular event might kick it off. A long-standing bit of organizing might kick it off. In Egypt, that was the case. It could be that some students become aroused and then the response kicks it off. Whatever happens, people begin to get it in their head that, wait a second, we can actually impact the situation. And that's the crucial leap that has to happen. People have to move from cynicism and despair and the belief that nothing's really possible and therefore I should just try and, you know, come through this surviving, to a belief that we can get together and do something productive here and make a situation that is beneficial for everybody instead of just for the rich.
I just want to gauge your optimism. You've been at this quite a while, reimagining new political and economic structures. Your book, Paracon, Life After Capitalism, Participatory Economics, is something you've talked about, written about, and done a lot of work on. Do you see similar signs of people looking for alternatives, trying to reimagine a future where we could actually put together a blueprint where there'll be some alternatives that are workable or pragmatic?
So yes, even if I didn't, I'd still be optimistic because history is long. And if we keep working and we keep functioning, you lose, you lose, you lose, you win. And you only have to win real liberty and real participation once. So my answer is I'd still be. But actually, in answer to your question, yes, at the moment I see tremendous potential. I think if Joe Hill, you know, an American organizer, came back tomorrow, he would look around and he would say, oh my gosh, this country is like, you know, an organizer's dream. Everybody understands that the basic institutions are corrupt and rotten and serve only narrow interests. Everybody gets that. Nobody even denies it. All of popular culture is full of novels and movies which show it. And he would say, in that context, with people's anger and with people's pain, it ought to be easy to organize people. Now, he'd be wrong, because that optical of hopelessness and cynicism is a hard one to overcome. But over the past few years, and at an escalating rate, I think it is beginning to get chipped away. And it is beginning to dissipate, and people are beginning to think positively rather than just bemoan their pain. And I don't think it takes long. Once you sort of turn a corner, and once people's mindset starts to shift, the speed with which it's possible for a new attitude to overtake large sectors of the population and lead to activity will be quite striking.
That was Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine and author of Paracon, Life After Capitalism. Read more about the Spanish protests by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.